Welcome to Value Through Vulnerability. This is a podcast dedicated to putting the human back into humanity, and I'm your host, Gary Turner. I'm also the founder of Hexo Change, and Hexo Change is a transformational change practice dedicated to helping you connect to yourself, to others, and to systems at large in a more meaningful way, thus helping us turn around our workplace and planetary challenges and accelerating how alive we all feel in every aspect of our lives. This track is called Kaleidoscope and was created for me personally and for Hexo Change by Peter Griffiths, one half of the amazing Mind Takeaway. I hope you enjoy this exploration and please do share it on your social platforms so we can bring more humanity to more people. Hope to speak to you soon. Welcome to Value Through Vulnerability. This is a podcast dedicated to putting a human back into humanity. And we're really excited to be partnering with Humans First. And we have today with us Humans First founder, Mike Vacanti. And we also have another awesome human in Sabrina Ellis, who is Director of Operations and Wellbeing at Gethin Ellis. So welcome to the podcast, Sabrina. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here today, Gary and Mike.
Oh, it's so good to see you. Let me just give a bit more of a lowdown as to who you are before we get into our exploration today. So Sabrina is a passionate and kind individual who is keen to keep moving forward whilst helping others with their progress. Throughout her experience as a registered mental health nurse and psychologist, Sabrina's passion has grown as an authentic leader as she strives to support and improve the personal and professional journeys of individuals. And this is really powerful, and I'm so grateful to you, for Sabrina, for what you're doing here. Sabrina also volunteers to provide free stress support and wellbeing sessions for NHS staff members who have experienced distress during COVID-19. Sabrina enjoys her role as a coach, supporting organisations with mental health and neurodiversity strategies, training and development. So tell us, Sabrina, like, where does that giving nature come from you, like to go out of your way to want to support for free our amazing National Health Service? Where does that origin story come from? Where's that drive and passion? I'd love to learn a bit more about that.
Yeah, of course, Gary, no trouble at all. For me, it just stems back to my childhood, always wanting to help my local community. Growing up, I cared for my mum, who suffered from mental health during my upbringing. So that was something from the age of 9 that was really strong around me and grew my passion to understand, well, how can I help my mother? And in turn, as I grew older, I studied psychology and went on to study to become a registered mental health nurse at the local university near where I live. And that was really, again, to understand, you know, how can we help people? How can I learn more about how each individual is unique and different? Because what I noticed was it's not a blanket effect for everybody, because everybody is unique and deserves the correct support. So during that journey of my nursing career of studying, that was within the NHS, and that's where I started my journey once qualified as well. I was very adamant at the type of unit I wanted to work on, which is called a PICU, Psychiatric Intensive Care Unit. Sounds very intense, but it was the safest place on earth. I absolutely loved that role. So my passion has always been there for the NHS service, because that's where I did my training.
It's so beautiful. Sorry, Mike, I'm going to just defer to you because I'm just sitting in that introduction.
You know, what's amazing is how you can stay in that giving place so strongly and so boldly. It speaks to just a great heart. And Sabrina, I know this a little bit because I have a daughter in nursing school right now. And the labs, or the section they're doing right now, is mental health. So she's working as a mental health student nurse. And so I'm getting some insights into how intense that can be. And so I know that to replenish yourself, sometimes some might feel that they need to step away. So I'm just taken by and so intrigued of your ability to even step in further and be there to help others. I'm overwhelmed by that giving spirit you're sharing.
Oh, thank you. it's so important for me because I've witnessed firsthand, you know, the effects of just having one person listen to somebody. And you think, well, what are the detriment to that individual if that person wasn't there to listen? Mm. You know, I recognise my own capabilities and boundaries professionally and personally. But if I can be that one person to listen, then I know I've made a difference straight away.
Yeah, and I can see how you light up people's lives with that smile that you share. And, you know, as we're in a difficult time right now, and we're seeing so many people affected by the pandemic and changes, you're well equipped to understand that these aren't just temporary situations, right? When you're working with those that are, you know, challenged with their mental fitness, that they don't know the end to it, or there may not be an end to it. And I think in some ways, in a temporary state, we know that this isn't going to be forever, but we also don't know much about the end of it. And so I'm interested what you're experiencing with people as you're helping them, you know, understand, settle in, get centered around this state that's in flux right now.
Yeah. Well, I'll go back to the beginning of March, really, when we started to hear more about the coronavirus. And my husband was due to speak at a conference in Belgium. So we'd arranged to go for this adult weekend, no children. And because we were hearing a little bit more about the coronavirus, we said, well, actually, I'll stay at home in case there is a quarantine procedure and both parents can't get back. And what that did for me was I had a weekend where I was looking at the following quarter of the year. And it suddenly impacted me that weekend of people aren't going to know what's coming, especially people that have not either recognised when they've been affected by mental ill health or have never experienced it before. You know, the increased risk of trauma or re-traumatisation as well. So when my husband got back, we arranged a meeting with our colleagues and employees, and I discussed with them my concerns of the months ahead. And my main concern was I need to help, and I think I need to step away from the business that me and my husband do own together, and I need to volunteer. I need to utilise my skills and knowledge that I developed through the NHS for the NHS, and I was supported by every person that I spoke with. So what we decided to do after a couple of months, I went on furlough. And by doing that, I've been able to completely volunteer, whether that's been in my local community, doing check-in and chat calls with the NHS Volunteer Responders Scheme, and with Project 5 as well, being a wellbeing and mental health specialist for them as well. And the biggest thing that I found in the local community, from people that are, whether they're shielding or at home on furlough or any other circumstances, the biggest thing was loneliness. And I spent a lot of time having a natter with somebody up the road. We don't know where anybody lives, and it's very confidential, that process. And just having a natter and a cup of tea with somebody who has been shielding, who feels very alone. You know, they feel their world's turned upside down because they're no longer working. So it's almost as if they lost their purpose. You know, their work was, you know, their get up and go in the morning or pop into the local shops and saying hello to the supermarket attendants. You know, that was their get up and go for that day. So to have lost that for weeks and weeks and then months on end was really big. So loneliness in my local community has been the biggest thing. Now, I spent some time reading quite a bit of research on how previous quarantines or pandemics in the world have affected individuals, and have recently provided some training to an organisation on being trauma-informed for their workforce. And one of the things that struck me is that the healthcare professionals, healthcare service, are more at risk. They're the highest risk for re-traumatisation. And what that means is that if they've experienced a trauma at any stage in their life, they are at higher risk of re-traumatisation through COVID-19. Now, they may not be able to link that or find out where that first originated from, but their signs and symptoms of mental ill health will be because of that re-traumatisation as well. So in providing the stress support and wellbeing sessions for the NHS staff was so crucial to me, to be able to say, I've got this space, I want to be able to provide that time, and I will go ahead with that.
It's an incredible use of the furlough scheme, probably the best example I've heard actually, Sabrina. No, but really, you know, to actually go out and leverage that space you're able to create is really commendable. And I'd love to come back to, as you opened up with this conversation, you keep using the word individual, and it keeps coming up time and time and time again. And I find that really interesting. Like, for someone that really cares as well about inclusion, you know, designing organizations around our people, like, what, where does that come from for you? Why is that a repeated theme in the work that you do, and maybe even your belief system around the individual?
I've never been asked that before, so that's a really good question. And I think it just comes back down to how I view the world, and I see people as individuals, and I respect individuals. It doesn't matter where they're from, what's their first language, what colour their hair is, it does not matter. What matters to me is the individual when I speak and I listen with them.
We could all learn from that right now. Yes. And I think that's, so Mike, I'd love to bring you in at this point. Is that not what we've been talking about with our human conversations? Is that ability to see the human first?
Yeah, so I'm sitting in it also, right? And not only is my mind spinning, but I'm feeling this calmness, right? My first thought is, oh please, more Sabrina in this world. With your commitment and then your understanding, it's really phenomenal. And everybody listening right now is not having, you know, the pleasure of the same experience of, you know, just your body language and your presence. It's quite special. And I can see why not only are you so effective at it, but how genuine that care is. And the advancement of each individual to their skills, their hopes, their beliefs, rather than directing them into some other place, someone else's beliefs, some other category, allowing them to have the space to be well where they are and to advance from there is really coming through very, very clear. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
I should have followed with a question, but I'm really just, I'm sitting in how special that is, and, you know, feel like spending time commending you as much as learning from you, because I think we all have so much to learn in taking that approach to create space for others and how impactful that is. And I think that follows on with the question, Sabrina, is how do people respond when you're creating that room for them to be present and as you're listening?
Well, I think that's related to them, as you said, about feeling calm. And I have been able to build really quick rapport, which have been very trusting and very open and honest with individuals. They know when I say it's a confidential space, it's a confidential space. How, and I always say this as well, however, if you present as a risk to yourself or somebody else, we will work through that as well, and we will find that support together. You know, so it's also just being open and transparent. You know, if they ask me a question regarding my experiences with mental health, I give that in a confidential way as well. To ensure that they can see that I can give them examples, but also maintain other people's confidentiality as well. But I was saying to my, Gary earlier that I went through some feedback today that I'd received, and it was really powerful because it enabled somebody to see something they'd never seen before and to really sit back and reflect on their own actions within their family. So we're not even talking just professional development, it's, well, what type of person do I want to be? How do I want to help my family? you know, and it's about just not focusing on people's professional roles, because behind that job title or that environment where they work is a human being. And it's relating that back to people that have worked so hard in their professional roles. It's to remind them that when they wake up in the morning, they're Sarah or they're Joe before their job title, or the different hats that they play with throughout the day, mum, dad, brother, sister, they're still a human when they get up in the morning, and it as an individual. And when they go to bed at night, they take all those hats off, and again, they go to bed as Joe, Sarah, or Mike up the road. So we've got to prioritise that individual, that you put the human first, which is you. And I think just empowering people with those words that, you know, no one's ever said that to me before, or I've never really taken a step back to prioritise myself other than those hats that they wear. You know, it's a powerful thing that I've, especially throughout COVID-19, I've experienced with individuals.
You've totally, I can't explain to you, my whole head, shoulders and arm is just buzzing like crazy, Sabrina, as you talk, genuinely. And it's, part of it is your message of the human before the job title. Mm. And I think that's so critical, because I myself, as someone I think mentioned this when we first met, was, you know, for the first 35 years of my life, I was striving for the next job, the next title, because I identified Gary will be good enough when. Yeah. So Gary will be worthy when he's got the next job title or the salary or the X. And I just think you're speaking so beautifully to that. How can we all come from a place of self-worth internally? And then we can build our job title. We can be the accountant or the psychologist or the movement maker afterwards. But how do we help people? And I'm just wondering, a bit of a question, I guess, as well, is, in your experience, what are some things to try and make this a bit actionable for people that may be a bit like, I'm that person that keeps striving for outside things in the hope it makes me feel complete. And there's no judgment in that. They're all good things. But what are some, maybe some ideas or experiences you've had around people making that journey sort of inwards, I guess, in a way? How do you help people get better with being who they are and not having to tie themselves to job titles, for example?
Well, I focus on two or three different things, really, because I focus on strength-based activities. So it automatically brings it down to the individual again, opposed to the role that they play. And I focus on asking them positive questioning, which is through positive psychology. So you're asking them questions which makes them reflect on a situation or something where they've had, you know, the best experience within that team or environment they've worked in. And then we actually look about activating and seeing their positive strengths. And I use positive strength cards, which have got pictures and the words on, and we work through them. And that works beautifully, because people, whether they're visual or, you know, auditory, they're able to see and hear the words. And, you know, memories will come to you every time you see a photograph or a flower, or, you know, it will bring a memory, and then it leads to such natural conversations as well. And also, just from a solution focused perspective, you know, somebody's not happy in a role, but this is a role they've worked 10 years for, they've got to that point and they're not happy. We look at like what's working well, and we become, rather than the problem focus, it's more focusing on the solution. How can we change that? You know, and that could potentially lead into a career counselling session for them also as well, because it can look at, well, what are they doing now? What makes them happy? But what else would they like to achieve? What would they like to do? And I think for me, through all of those scenarios, I would always use positive questions. You know, I'd ask you, Gary, you know, what does Gary like to do? You've got to take all of those hats off. There's no job title. There is no brother, you know, father, nothing like that on the table, right? You've got no hat on your head. What does Gary like to do? And you'll be surprised how many people can't answer that question because they're so busy with all of these hats. They couldn't tell me. So sometimes it's about finding out, well, what's working well, even though, you know, they may be in a distressing or negative state of mind at the time. But when we really do pull it in and become solution focused, and the positivity that comes from it, you know, I always try and stick to my time slots, but they do go over. And it's just, I'm not going to cut somebody off if they're talking, so we just carry on.
And Mike, I'm sitting here now laughing at myself because the question you've just asked, what is Gary like? I know what difference I'm trying to make. I know the direction of travel, but what do I actually like? Like, I couldn't, like, I like pizza. Like, I like pizza way too much, but, you know, in terms of what do I like about this, I don't sit down very often to actually properly go, what do I really like? That's really interesting.
Yeah, so my sessions are always client-led. It's about that client. So, you know, they'll gravitate towards a topic and we'll discuss it very naturally. But I'll always, you know, if needed, I'll bring something which is positively focused in psychology, solution-focused for their thinking, you know, if it's gone off on a bit of a too far of a tangent. And it's just bringing it back. I always bring it back down into them, you know. It works really well.
Yeah, centered on the individual, and to stay focused in that so diligently is, I mean, what a gift that you're sharing with all of us today. But to dedicate your professional work toward it, and then to step away from the professional work, I'm coming back to that, and volunteering to do that. And one of the things that we hear about with that type of care work that you're doing, and you talk about it's difficult in the nursing profession where they, you know, they like a past trauma can reemerge. So does that fit into, you know, I hear about trauma fatigue. Does that play into that, or how does that sit within that type of work environment that those professional nurses are in?
Just read the question, sorry, Mike.
Yeah, does compassion fatigue play a role in that reemergence of past traumas?
It can, yeah. And again, it's all about the individual, and that could be, you know, the differences between somebody who's male and female, somebody who's an older generation to a young generation. So there's so many different variables to be considered within, you know, how traumas can come around and how the re-traumatization can come around for somebody as well. There's just so many different variables involved in it, because one of the questions I was previously asked is, you know, by somebody, am I at higher risk of a trauma? And I said, well, we actually went through some research, because they were very strategy focused. And it was around by saying, you know, these are all the high risk, these are medium risk, and these are lower risk. But in COVID-19 especially, the people that are at risk is anybody. Because we've all had to make changes without ever having to go through this before. So when you think about, you're saying the compassionate fatigue in healthcare staff, you know, they may be used to dealing with loss within the workplace, but how does that affect them when they have to take over the roles of the family, when the family have not been able to visit? How does that then affect them? Have they lost any family members? And you see then the links emerging where, you know, they deserve support, and, you know, it's accessible out there within the trust and with charities now being approved by the NHS. And the aim for that is to look at the early intervention opposed to seeing them at crisis. And this is why I absolutely love Project 5, because the initiative came around because of COVID-19, and it will be here to stay for a while.
Really interesting. Really. And Gary, it wasn't like I totally jumped tracks. I was running parallel there, because I was I was taking some free therapy. So I apologize to all the listeners for being selfish here. But, you know, during this time, you and I both, Gary, we get a chance to talk to people from all over the world, right? And we have our networks. And I have been doing a lot of listening to people that are making big adjustments to their business to get back online and become financially healthy. They haven't really cared for themselves physically necessarily during this period of time. So there's been some of those conversations, and there's been a lot of listening. And the reason I asked, Sabrine, is at this stage now that we're months into it, I find myself with more moments of lower energy and with doubts. And it feels like weakness to me. And so I was really just wondering, you know, is that the experience? Does that start to deplete energy over time when not being a professional, not having those tools to be in that listening environment was where I was going with that.
Yeah, it definitely can. What you'll find is that even professionals that are equipped with the tools and knowledge can still be fatigued. They can still feel, gosh, you know, we've been listening and I just feel, you know, I don't have any energy today. So that can happen to professionals with those skills, knowledge and experience as well.
I've got a question, Sabrina, because it's amazing, like, again, just amazing how much you're giving nature. What does Sabrina do from a self-care point of view for yourself to make sure that you are keeping yourself well, mentally, physically, etc.? I'm just really interested to explore that with you.
Yeah, this makes me chuckle a little bit because my friends all know me very well and my colleagues, that my time management has always been impeccable. So I'm able to allocate time everywhere that it's necessary, whether it's business, family. But over time, I think especially over the past 5 years, I've had to put in some self-care, especially being burnt out in previous roles in healthcare. It's, well, you know, that question of, well, what do I like to do? What don't I want to do? What don't I want to do today? If I don't want to do something, I won't. And it's actually having that determination to follow through in something that you want to do or don't want to do. So I love to read. And I've actually got a list in my phone of, you know, books that I've been reading. And I'm currently reading Harry Potter, so our youngest son, when he goes for his naps, and what I'm finding is that when he's fallen to sleep, I continue to read because that's what I want to do. So that's what I do. So as much as that's, you know, the task, so to speak, is to put the toddler to bed, he goes to sleep. But what I want to do then is I don't want to rush around the house and put an extra load of washing in or check my emails. It's, well, I want to read some more of this book. Some of the times, you know, I love going for walks, so family walks, but also I like to have that time to myself. So sometimes my family will go on a walk and I don't. And I'll sit, and whether that's listening to music or just rest. So it's actually focusing on not, it's not selfish to want to be alone. And I'm not sad for the reason I want to be alone. I just like my own company sometimes.
But not to do, that's so big, right? That's as important of a decision as what to do. What do you like? Gary likes pizza. What is it that you like?
I love chocolate, Mike. That's what was making me chuckle, because if my friends could answer it, they'd say, decaf coffee, chocolate. She's all yours. Yeah, it's my favourite. I never change. Biscuits. Oh, I love biscuits. I'm a big snacker. So I just run it off.
That's fabulous. I love that.
I'm really interested. I see a segue here, if I may take us there, Sabrina and Mike, towards the workplace. And what I'm thinking of is that this, what you like and what you don't like, I think we give away that choice when we go to work quite a lot. When we do put on the job title armor, or the I need to be strong armor, I can't show my emotions armor in the workplace, I find generally, and it's, I don't want to be stereotypical, but my lived experience of work over the last 20 years has been, we tend not to say no, or we tend not to have the difficult conversation around. I read a book called Essentialism by Greg McKeown once. I'm not sure if either of you have read that, but it's one of the biggest learnings for me about 6 years ago was saying no gracefully. So for example, in case this is helpful for the listeners, you've got five things that you've got to do. Line manager comes in or leader says, right, we need this done now. Which one of those other five things would you like me to drop so I can get that work on that one? That's not the sort of conversation that's commonplace in my experience. And I wonder, Sabrina, what's your experience of working with organizations and around that ability to say no or to say that I don't like this? How common is that?
It's actually very common. And now you've just highlighted it to me. Having clients where, you know, you have to introduce that in the conversation. And it's, you know, how often do you say no? You know, leading towards stress and burnout and overworking in any environment, not just in healthcare. And it's, you know, your strength is communication. So we'll focus on communicating effectively and say no without saying no. Like you say, saying it gracefully and, you know, building on a relationship with their managers or colleagues is something that I've worked quite a lot with individuals. Because as you said, people don't like to say no because they don't want, you know, to feel judged or, you know, oh, well, you know, we've asked someone, so that could, you know, lead to something negative in the future. It's saying, well, okay, I'm more than happy to do that, but I do have these tasks to do today. You know, I will put that as a priority, but I just won't be able to get this done until tomorrow or Wednesday. And just having that open communication, you know, I think that works well.
It's funny. I know Mike and I are sharing exactly the same experience of you, Sabrina. It's like we could, it'd be really boring for the listener, but I could just sit here in silence 10 minutes. But it'd be an awful podcast.
Yeah, because there's so much processing with that, right? And the thing is as you're sharing, Sabrina, it's easy to all of a sudden play that movie and reflect how many times have I been in that situation? Yeah. And how many times have I been the person that's approached? And how well did I listen? How well did I understand the opportunity to provide choice to those that, you know, as we're discussing objectives? And I know that as a leader, I was not a directive type person because we look at outcomes and I trusted people to act against them. But how well did I do that? I mean, that's why I got quiet and was reflecting so much on that, because every day there'd be an opportunity to do that better. Every day, as a leader or as I'm dealing with my superior, there'd be an opportunity to do that better almost every day. That's really powerful. And because Gary, you said, how often do we miss that? And I mean, as often as the wind blows, I think.
Yeah, you just want to think about during my master's degree that I completed last year, I underwent a research project and it's entitled The Work Experiences of Autistic IT Professionals, which was a qualitative study. So I picked that back up last week and started my research summary for me to be able to share. And one of the things that struck me from what you've just said is that within that, one of my participants that I interviewed actually shared an experience of receiving an email very late at night, and the implications on that person was that they had no reply. They didn't know what the meeting was for. They thought they was in trouble and nearly took their own life. So that is how detrimental something can be, where somebody may be working and think, oh, I'm just going to send this email because I'm off tomorrow, send it without scheduling it for an appropriate time. And that is how far that can have an effect on somebody. You know.
Wow, that's devastating. That just sent chills. Yeah. Not knowing the gravity of our actions. Oof. That one I think we can sit in for a moment, Gary. I mean, how many degrees removed from that tragic event are there detrimental ramifications to those unconscious, almost unconscious actions, right? Mm-hmm. And the invitation, therefore, to be conscious in our communications, respecting other situations, their time. Powerful, Sabrina. That is great teaching.
It's blown my mind, and I'm quickly coming out of it. But what I went through as I reflected there, Sabrina, was a momentary guilt, because I know I've done that without the, you know, that the late night emails. I do it less, but the thoughtlessness of sending that email. But the irony that if we don't send those emails, A, we avoid that risk. But B, if we're not sending the email, it means we're with our family or we're reading a book. So it's like a win-win to not be that person sending the email at 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
And it's just really sitting with me, the severity, though, of that unconscious act. And I'd like maybe to... It just got me. That's really struck me very, very hard. But I'd like you to speak a little bit. You opened up your introduction around the neurodiverse. Maybe we can sort of segue into that, because you said about your work being around, or a passion around, neurodiversity. And of course, you know, autism and other aspects feed into that. Would you mind just speaking to that a little bit? And maybe some invitations for the people that are listening that are maybe as struck as Mike and I right now, that go about their daily work, doing the best they can, but haven't really thought about those peripheral sort of risks, shall we say. You know, is there any other sort of invitations or recommendations of how, what people should or maybe think about? Or maybe is it just back to that, you know, make a point of knowing everyone in your team individually so that you can get to know that those risks or triggers? I don't know.
Yeah. One thing I would say is that a formal diagnosis does not define a person. For me personally and professionally, a diagnosis is there to enable me to communicate and learn more about that individual and how they will communicate, all their preferences. But with the research that I looked into during my studies, it was around autism, a formal diagnosis. But there are so many different neurodiverse conditions, dyspraxia, Tourette's syndrome, ADHD, you know, there's so many. And one of the biggest things I would say to anybody is, just because somebody hasn't disclosed they have a diagnosis, whether it's a formal or a self-diagnosis, doesn't mean they can't or shouldn't have the support within the workplace, because they should, most definitely. But it shouldn't have to take somebody to bear themselves vulnerable to an organisation, excuse me, to gain that support. And my driver around that is that our eldest son, he's 14 in a couple of weeks, and he's towers over me, he's over 6 foot now. And he has a formal diagnosis of ASD, autism spectrum disorder. And I think about the workplaces now, and I think about them in the future for my son. And I want people to be able to understand his needs, whether he chooses to disclose or not, and to feel supported in organisations. And that's something that's really powered through, again, about the individual. You will never meet 10 people with a formal or self-diagnosis of ASD that are exactly the same. All different. So you can't have a blanket effect either. So it's about getting to know your teammates. You know, can they come into work a bit later? Can they start at 10 o'clock? You know, some people are naturally late risers as well. Even down to when the clocks change, that can be very distressing especially the participants I interviewed in my study. It took them weeks to get used to the time when the clocks go back and forward, and it would take them weeks to get into a routine at work. So that could be something where around that time, you know, they could have additional flexible working or staggered starts to and from work. And it's about trusting your employees, you know, and just treating people as individuals. That's how they want to be treated. You know, there's something where one of my participants was actually going to HR with, you know, these are the recommendations, this is what I should have, and fighting for her cause for these recommendations within the workplace, opposed to the workplace saying, well, how can we look after each individual? How can we ensure we're making the environment or the work tasks, the pressures at work, you know, so manageable for each individual to work at their best? What does working at the best look like for each individual?
Absolutely, yes. I don't know if there's many more statements that could align more closely with my professional work environment cultural beliefs than what you just said, and I will never be able to repeat it as eloquently as you did. So I'm going to go back for that clip. My wife worked in the autism program in the school district for many years, right? And there were up to 40 kids, you know, in any one year in that program. And so the spectrum is very broad and very different, and they were not anyone alike. Mm-hmm. And I know some of them now as adults, and it would be unrecognizable that they were in that program or receiving assistance when they were in high school. And it's quite amazing. And what I love so much, Sabrina, is that flexibility in the environment for all people. And it's not just those, as you said, with a formal diagnosis, but we work differently. We all work differently. Some of us work in bright bursts and in a moment's time, sometimes in the 11th hour is where all of the creativity and all of the brilliant work gets done. Others, perhaps like you, who are, you know, very capable and diligent with time management, can keep that constant pace, right? And always be producing at a high level on a very consistent basis. They're different, not necessarily better. And you know, how brilliant it is when we can team people together with those two different traits or skills or behavior preferences, idiosyncrasies, we can call them. And I think that's often missed, right? Is we are unlike each other in that sense, and therefore it seems like we would be opposed rather than complementary. And I imagine that you get into some of those teaming dynamics as you're doing work with individuals.
It's something we've done as well, because we're working with an occupational psychologist in training and our operations research analysis, where we're going to be doing a lot of research. It commenced last week, the formalities of that to go ahead, and around inclusion. What does inclusion mean? You know, we don't just want to focus on one particular area of equality and diversity. We want to be able to offer it to everybody. And just going back on, I think when Gary originally asked about, you know, why do I always use the word individual? And I think for me, through this discussion today, it's because I love looking after the whole person from a holistic manner. And that stems right back to my mental health training, the whole person, you know. So yeah, that's definitely something within our organisation that's embedded in our culture moving forward. We're just starting to expand the business from this year, and that's something we're very keen on ensuring that's within the culture and, you know, the practice of our business, that, you know, it is open for opportunities. We're not saying we're going to have an autism program or a, you know, a black organization, you know, and project. We're saying it's equal opportunities. There's research we're doing at the moment to ensure that's embedded in the culture before having anybody else on board, before looking at a job description, the job analysis phase of recruiting and selecting individuals, you know. So we're putting a lot of hard work into that at the moment, you know, living by the true values that we are going to put the human back into technology. And we are going to treat everybody as an individual.
Tell you what, this is like, we're nearing the end now. Sabrina, I just love that. And I just want to bring in, if we may riff on this final topic, is, so I put out a LinkedIn post actually this morning, because you're speaking the inclusion piece, this opportunity to see the individual. I think we've probably got the biggest opportunity in a generation as people go back to whatever their work looks like, to allow people to design life of which work is a part. But I'm hearing a number of leaders get back in the office, because that trust issue you spoke about, I think we're really about to see an explosion in transparency around who is really open and wants to see the individual and allow them to design work and life in combination, versus those that are desperate to micromanage still, even after the pandemic. And I wonder if you sort of, are you seeing any of that sort of showing up in the work that you're doing, or maybe some of that tension at the moment?
Yeah, something that's coming straight to my mind is that the difference between the option to go into the office and remote working. Some people are choosing to go into the office because they feel like it's a big brother eyes on them at home. They're having to account for every minute. So when we're doing work through the coaching sessions and we're focusing on their well-being, breaks, their workstations, you know, their routine, what time they start and finish. When they're in the office, they don't work over, they finish on time. When they're at home, they're working over. They have to ensure that when they present their work to their manager, they know they've done it. They know they've done it to the best of their ability, but they want to ensure they can account for every minute, whereas they don't have that worry on them in the office. So we're actually seeing it the other way in a respect that people are wanting to go into the office to separate, you know, being at home and being at work, where there are others that are loving being at home because they naturally flourish in that environment, away from open offices. And, you know, there's some flexible working that I've been working on with individuals, discussing the co-coaching with their managers as well.
That's right. And again, I love it. I love the fact you've come back with the alternative view. And again, what I'm hearing, it's personal. So not sheep dip. It's actually what works best for you. Ultimately, someone might have caring responsibilities. Someone might have disability to manage. Someone might just prefer a better balance. And is that not an opportunity now to really design work for that, so we can see more of that individual? I guess is probably my summary point.
Definitely. That's my answer. Definitely. You know, even down to, you know, it's not something where I'm discussing it with others so they can lead and think about their opportunities. It's something I've done within myself. So from September, I'll be working part-time in my business. And I've already got my day settled. It'll be 3 days in the week. But then on the third day, I'll have a half a day to pick my son up from nursery, and I'll have the whole afternoon just me and him. So being at home with three children, it's made me think, gosh, you know, the little things I miss, having a picnic in the park spontaneously, not planned all week for the weekend. So I want a bit more of this. So I've already put that into action. And I've got a meeting to attend tomorrow to discuss that further with our employees, just to ensure they're in the loop and leading up until September with those changes, but they will be very supported in the process as well.
What modeling that you're providing, not only for your employees and your family, but for all of us, as to the power of those choices. Yeah. And the understanding of self to know what actions to take, even to what to ask for. I'm really struck by the statement, the example you shared, where people are actually selecting to go back into the office to get out from under the microscope of being at home. There's just such a paradox in that it's mind-blowing, right? I'm going to go back to the less intense environment of the workplace because the way I'm being monitored while I'm at home is very intrusive, what I heard you say. That's
yeah definitely, Mike, because they're actually building negative emotions associated with that work and that role, but it's also within their home. So I've been doing a lot of work around the positive emotions and just that reconnectivity around that home environment or activities. For people that definitely want to separate work and home now as well.
Yeah, phenomenal. One question that struck me in it, and so when you say put the human back into technology or put the human into technology, question for you, because I love technology, I've been in it for a long time and certainly believe in, you know, the mission of the individual and the human. Is it to have humanistic traits in the technology, or to what's first in that? Is it to make technology more human, or is it to build technology better for better use of humans?
Yeah.
Better use by humans, not of humans. Forgive me for.
But the work we've been doing is around the psychology within the workplace. And what the feedback we got from our clients is that they love, and this is where it came from, they love the human interaction that they gain through our company. So it's an IT consulting and training company. Everything could be done remotely from anywhere in the world. But what they have a face, they have a name, they know who they're speaking to, they feel reassured. And there's that trusting the human element of our service that we provide. So it's not just an IT and consulting and training company. They know the humans within that environment, within that workplace. And it's something where it becomes, even though it's a professional organisation, it becomes very personal, you know. So they know the person they're speaking to, they know preferred times to contact, you know, and it's mind-blowing, really, the feedback we received, because it was around, you know, we love the human interaction that you offer. If we have somebody that's 250 miles away, we will have that meeting in person. If that's their preference, it's not a problem at all.
Respective relationships. I'm hearing you say that relationships are so key, and that's beautiful. So the IT services space, I understand that, and that totally makes sense. And what a phenomenal focus and a difference that makes. Yeah. Just love you sharing that. Thank you for clarifying for me.
Oh, you're welcome.
I'm so excited to listen back to this and get my clips already, because I'm just, Sabrina, we knew it would be a wonderful exploration, and I just want to thank you for how you show up, the support and care you give other people, and for sparing the time with us today. It's been really, I don't often say it, it's been a beautiful conversation. I've really enjoyed the exploration, and I would love you to leave for our kind listeners that have joined us the best way to try and find you.
So you can find me on LinkedIn. It's Sabrina Ellis. I'm also on Twitter as well, Sabrina Ellis. And our website is gethanellis.com. It will be being updated very soon with the services we're going to provide for the psychology at work.
Amazing. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Sabrina.
Thank you.
Bye.
Hi there, just Gary Turner wrapping up this wonderful exploration with Sabrina Ellis and Humans First founder Mike Vicente. A few of the key things that I wanted to leave with you that really struck me today was when Sabrina shared that to ask the question, what don't I want to do today? I thought that's a really, really powerful question. You know, quite often we're looking at what we need to do, or we've got a to-do list, but what about the not-to-do list? What are the things that you want to do less of? Or the things that you need to say no to. I'd love to know how that resonates, and is there something that you're going to be saying no to today? And why is that? Do let me know. Gary@garyturner.life is my email. I also thought it's powerful that Sabrina shared that it's not selfish to be alone. I myself realise over the last couple of years that I'm certainly an ambivert. I really enjoy my own space, and in fact I'll have some of my own space down on the UK coastline this coming week, and I enjoy that. You know, I love my family to pieces, but sometimes to have those moments, those days to be able to be with yourself, it's definitely not a selfish act. And I see it in so many, particularly working mothers in my network and in my close family. You know, there is that working parent guilt, and I think, you know, we really can't be the best for others unless we're best for ourselves. I truly, truly believe that. And final thing I'd like to leave with you is that Sabrina also shared that at the moment with the whole pandemic, you know, sometimes people want to be back in the office because they find it very difficult to set boundaries. And also it appears that some organisations are actually micromanaging remotely, looking to try and get justification as to where their people are for every minute when they're not in the office. I call this really I'm calling it the trust crunch with the pandemic. Yes, some people do want to be in the office. Some people want to work remote. My good friend Perry Timms put out a poll on Twitter a couple of weeks ago, and it was unanimous. There's sort of less than 1% or less than 2% of the well over 1,000 respondents wanted to be in the office full time. So I think there's really going to be this trust crunch, and that, of course, is going to have a whole range of different impacts on different people as we go back to whatever a version of normal is that that works for us on an individual and collective level.
So really enjoyed this chat with Sabrina. We hope that you found value in it. We'd love for you to share the podcast with your communities and families and colleagues at work, should it offer value to you. And until next time, this was Gary Turner with Mike Vacanti and Sabrina Ellis. Thank you.
Really hoping that you enjoyed that exploration on the Value Through Vulnerability podcast. You can find out much more about Hexo Change at hexochangenow.com. That's hexochangenow.com. You can subscribe to a weekly newsletter at that website, which includes information about live stream conversations, further service offerings, blogs, but also our in-person events, of which we have multiple each year. So I really hope that you'll join us. Do connect with me, Gary Turner, on LinkedIn, and I really hope to hear from you soon.